said, if you were here a little bit earlier tonight, we are looking at the 14th week in our study.
Screen on here.
And so the reading was in the last third of the book of Numbers, chapters 23 through 36. And in those chapters, I'm asking that you turn over to page 187 to start tonight, which would be chapter 33. So for just a moment, we're going to jump out of the arrangement, you know, as it's presented in the book of Numbers, which already is in chronological order. But since we have come to the very last camps of the Jews in the wilderness, I thought that we'd do maybe even a little more math work tonight than we typically do, since these 40 years are now coming to an end. And I just wanted you to note on page 187, that, and that is a photograph of the Sinai wilderness, that as you read down through that, you can just scan, starting at verse 5, the children of Israel moved from Ramesses and camped at Sukkoth. Then, in verse 6, they departed from Sukkoth and camped at Etham. And from that point on, nearly to the end of the chapter, all the way through verse 49, you will have that form. They had come to this place, and then they departed from that place, and they camped at the next place. So I went through, and I highlighted each of these place names, and then in the margin, I was just curious, so I went through and I numbered every one. In chapter 33 of the book of Numbers, as the Jews now are very close to entering their promised land, and their journeyings are completed. They're a matter of a few months away from the end of this 40th year and from the end of the deprivations and the sufferings that they've experienced in these last four decades. There are 41 camps that summarize all of the places they've been in those years. Now, on occasion, we're given information about how long they stayed at a place, when they arrived, when they left. And so the fact that there are 41 camps in chapter 33 should not be taken to suggest that they stayed a year at every place. It's not like that at all. If that had been the case, then they would not have needed for the pillar of cloud to move, to be telling them when it was that they were to depart. But in the course of these 40 years, they will move 41 times from Ramesses in the beginning until finally they enter that promised land. So if you'll direct your attention to the screen for just a few minutes, now we're not going to look at all 41, of these different places, as the great majority of them have been lost to the sands of time now. We don't know where they are. But I will show you what are the maybe best described as traditional route, and even that is routes plural, of where the Jews roughly would have been in the course of the wilderness wandering in this clearly triangular area known as the Sinai Peninsula. Now, I recognize, of course, that at this level you can't read any of those place names. I just wanted you to see that they started off in Ramesses, that they headed out to the east, crossed miraculously over the water, through the water. They then moved in a southerly direction, apparently along the coast, all the way down, not quite to the very tip of the Sinai Peninsula, where it is thought, most people believe, that Sinai, the mountain itself, is down here in this region. There are those, and I don't know how to evaluate it, who suggest that the mountain itself is over here in Midian. I'm not even sure why they do that. If you see maps to that effect, it's an alternate idea. And I guess any one is as valuable as another from the standpoint God did not choose to reveal enough about these camping locations or even the mountain itself that we could really duplicate any of it today. It's not his intention that we should. So if you take the traditional route, you'll note here is a different color than here and then there. So let me blow up the legend that you saw down in the lower left-hand corner. And what they're doing on this map is saying that in red, you have the route from Egypt to Mount Sinai. Clearly, that is one journey, and then they're going to stay at Sinai for a long time, and many things are going to happen there. Then they're going to leave Sinai, and the purple arrow takes them to Kadesh Barnea, where they were apparently on at least two occasions, and where, again, they're spending a lot of time, and very important things are taking place, and much of the book of Numbers takes place here at Kadesh Barnea. We'll look at it in just a second.
And then finally, it's time to go. It's time to go to the promised land. So in the green, they leave Kadesh Barnea, and they head actually to Mount Nebo, which is also called Mount Pisgah.
Pisgah and Nebo are the exact same place. Different countries, different nations, different names. And so, finally, from Mount Nebo, Moses will view the promised land, and then the Jews will enter. So there's the map again, the three colors, and we're going to zoom into that area I put in the border right there.
And I want you to see here that this peninsula now is formed by the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba. And from Ramses, they have come through the great majority of this entire peninsula. And especially because once we get up into this region, that it takes about a year to get here, it'll be 39 years of wilderness wandering. And as we saw last week, what detail do we get in the book of Numbers or anywhere else about the 39 years? None. We just don't get any. And yet, we got 41 listed encampments. And so, likely, they were wondering who knows where for 39 years that we just have absolutely no knowledge about. They may have crisscrossed that peninsula, you know, a dozen times. There's just no way to know. So the arrow brings us to that location because it's an anchor place in the scriptural record from which now they're going to head over to the south end of the Dead Sea in an attempt now to head on up into the Promised Land from first this side and then that side.
It is the west and then the eastern reaches of the Dead Sea. Let's zoom in one more time just to this last part.
Here's the Gulf of Aqaba. They come through the wilderness of Paran. They come up to the most likely locations for Kadesh Barnea. And then, in a minute, we'll see some more detail about their desire to head straight in. That will be defeated because of their own faithlessness. All these 39 years of wandering will take place. They'll come back to Kadesh Barnea and work their way around. Be unable to come through the land of the Edomites, and will be forced to go around them. Notice on this map, and you'll see on the others as well, with all this bubbly stuff that runs all the way through there. Mountains. And so there's only going to be certain places where a massive number of people like this would even be able to find a path that they could safely get through, you know, to work with. So they're trying to come through this particular region right here, and they're rebuffed. And they have to make a ginormous journey, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles, to get around that country all the way back down to the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba and then back up again. So now, let's switch to a different map. We'll be only here briefly, but again, this one is traditional route of the Exodus. We'll zoom in a minute, but once again, they're suggesting here's Ramses, cross on dry land, down to Mount Sinai, thought to be here, back up to Ezion Geber, also known as Elath, which is right here at the north end of the Gulf of Aqaba, here to Kadesh Barnea, a lot of adventures there, then over here, can't get into Edom, back down to Ezion Geber, and up again. But it's this right here, and in fact, this whole black line right here that I wanted you to take note of. It is mentioned in the scripture there. I'm going to zoom in on just that corner now, where it's identified. Can you read it? What's that? The King's Highway. Clear back in those days, they had roads just like we do. They had to travel, of course, always on foot or camel, you know, donkey back. But they still were the regular roads. They're the best roads, they're the least mountainous roads, they're the safest roads, you know, and they're the shortest roads. The King's Highway ran from the Mediterranean Sea from west to east to the Gulf of Aqaba. Virtually everybody that's trading, thanks to that seaport, and then making, you know, a journey by land, is going to be using the King's Highway. But immediately at that same location, north tip of Aqaba, heads due north. And the King's Highway runs through all this land and far beyond Israel itself. It is serving anybody that wants to go to what we call Europe, or anybody that would be going over the Fertile Crescent, heading off into the regions that we typically refer to as Assyria or Babylon, Mesopotamia, the area between Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Now, here's a third map. Hold on. You know, I know sometimes map work's a little difficult, but this Kadesh Barnea, brethren, is really interesting and important. And God brought them there on more than one occasion. And some of the most significant events in Jewish history take place there. And this is a new map to me. I just found this one in my studies this week and thought I'd share it with you right here. But this map has been turned 90 degrees. So now, instead of classic, you know, north at the top, north is on your left. East is at the top. So all those maps I showed you have been tilted now 90 degrees. And here's Kadesh Barnea. So, they come to Kadesh Barnea in the first year. Then, they send 12 spies out along this dotted green path. And they're going through the territory of Amalekites, and Amorites, and Canaanites, Hittites, and Jebusites. They're passing through all these different regions, and they're coming back with the bounty of the land, and it's wondrous. But they also see fortified cities and real big people. So the spies come back to Kadesh Barnea, and they give a bad report, 10 of them do. Moses, pretty upset about it, is told by God, and they rebuke, Moses rebukes the people. In this case, kind of unusual for them it seems, they repent. They say, okay, we're sorry, so we're going to try and go in anyway now. We're real sorry, let's go. So they head off in some kind of direction through here and try to enter that promised land anyway. What happens? Well, it fails. Moses didn't go with them. The Ark of the Covenant didn't go with them. They get defeated. Now, here's where I thought it got kind of interesting. When they got routed, they were chased all the way to Hormah. H-O-R-M-A-H. One word. Question mark on this map, because again, no, we're not entirely sure it could have been anywhere in this region. But they were chased back to Hormah. So, roundly defeated, running for their lives, finally, you know, they get the people chasing them give up, you know, here at Hormah. So we have all these arrows. They then, being repulsed, come on back to Kadesh Barnea. Now let me go ahead and zoom in. Remember, they didn't try to go due east. They can't get through Edom. They have to go all the way back to the Gulf of Aqaba and make the long journey around. So let's do some zooming in on this map. Look at it right here. Here, this is also called the Wilderness of Zin. Spies go out. They come back. Kadesh Barnea. We make an attempt to get defeated at Hormah. We come back to Kadesh Barnea. Now, last week's reading, in Numbers 14, that event is revealed. Then, in Numbers 20, again from last week's reading, they did not leave Kadesh Barnea. They sent messengers to appeal to the Edomites. We would like to use the King's Highway. We'd have to pass through some of your lands to do that. Can we? What was the answer? No. What was their plea? We'll buy everything, you know, we're a ruling, you know, customer for you. We'll treat you right. Still, what's the answer? Yeah, no way. So they come back, well, you know, that's not going to work. And so, in Numbers 20, they now leave Kadesh Barnea, but they don't go very far at all. Because I can do it on this map with the span of my hand. From Kadesh Barnea, here we think, question mark again, is where Aaron died. This is Mount Hor. How long did they spend there in mourning for Aaron? 30 days. So 30 days in mourning, and then the journey begins. So they then in 21 come back up through this region now. They're all in the march again. And I don't know if you caught this, and I think I kind of fumbled last week with it. Hormah comes up again. There's two times that Hormah comes up. What happens the second time in Numbers 21? Hey, they win this time. And this time, they chase their enemies all the way to Hormah. Okay, so it turns out it's fair play. And what you got is 39 years passed. But what the fathers had failed to do and met with defeat, many died and got routed and had to run to Hormah. This time it's 39 years later, all of those people have died, and their children and grandchildren now have that success. at that same location.
So there's a, you know, it's sort of a revenge, I guess.
Sure.
No, that's coming up. Yeah, it's a little bit further. Let's see, did I... Oh, I just want to go back to this map again. Yeah, and I forget what chapter that's in, but it did come up later. Okay, so now they're making this giant circle here, and they're headed what would be south. The map is tilted back here to Ezion-Geber, also known as Elath, also known to us as the north end of the Gulf of Aqaba. And then what are they doing with these mountains? They're circumventing the mountains. The whole deal is they've got to get around them. When they get on the other side, starting here at Gulf of Aqaba, they are getting on to the King's Highway, which you can barely see through here, and the King's Highway comes through here too. So it meets right here. These were the best routes, so they're both called King's Highway if you're going north from Ezion-Geber or east from the Mediterranean Sea. They're both called the King's Highway. Right there they meet, and then they're going to be essentially following that highway now on the other side of the Edomites, on the other side of all these various problems. But look now at the map on 186. So you're on that page already. It's associated with numbers 33. So you've got this map, and on the right-hand side, and I've also put it on the screen, from Kadesh Barnea, Moses wanted to go east through Edom and then north through Moab toward Canaan. Being refused passage through both territories, he instead went south to Elath, that's Ezion-Geber, then north and east, bypassing Moab and Edom. Now you'll note that the line that they show on this map is not the same line we have on the other map. We don't know the actual course that they took. So, and again, some wandering around and looking for, easier pathways and that sort of thing. But that is the third and final region that they'll be passing through. Now, let's back up to page 173. On page 173, I was running out of time last week, and so just only in passing, I mentioned these two guys. But now, I've got another map for you here.
Here, turn the map back to the north. Here's Elath, Ezion-Geber. They come back up here. They're on the King's Highway or adjacent to it. And way up here at the top, you've got this little explosion sign, and it says, Battle with Sihon. Okay, here's the Zered River, the Arnon River, the Jabbok will be up north right there, and the rivers generally are identifying the areas that these various kingdoms and kings are living in. Now over here on the right, all we've done is take the same map maker, but blown up the area that is north of here. Dead Sea, 100 miles of the Jordan River, finally we come to what is called the Sea of Kinnereth. You know it as the Sea of Galilee, okay? This is the approximate territory that we call Bashan that was under the control of Og. They were able to defeat first Sihon, he's the guy immediately south, and that's that battle up there, and then north of that, here's all this region of Bashan that Og was in control of, and we're told that at Edrei, they defeated him. I think what most people don't realize is that, we think, well, they were down in the Sinai Peninsula, and they had to go around Edom, and then they went to Mount Pisgah, and they crossed over at the top of the Dead Sea, and they entered the Promised Land. That's the way it kind of gets stuck in our head. But what actually happened? They went up and down and far north on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and they were conquering a very large region up in there that was outside the border of the Jordan River, which marked the eastern edge of the Promised Land. So they were, before they ever got to the Promised Land, and after all the problems and defeats that they had had militarily, now as they are getting ready finally after 40 years to enter that land flowing with milk and honey, how are they doing militarily? They're doing real well. They just can't be defeated. Those Edomites chased them out, and then they came back and they started whooping up on everybody,
you know, as they're coming through. And they are claiming that territory now for whom?
For themselves, for Israel, and for God. So while that is outside the promised land, nonetheless, God is blessing them with success there, and they are gaining some confidence, I would suppose,
as battle after battle goes their way before they're going to finally head in and face those giants, you know, and all that problem that they had there before. So, I just want to spend that little bit more time with Sihon and Og, get you know, an understanding of how well they're doing. And then last week, we actually closed the chapter 22. I didn't want to touch on Balaam. How many of you were here Sunday night? Raise your hand if you were here Sunday night. Okay, I knew that'd be the case. It's just, there's hardly an exception out there. It was terrific. I really appreciate your attendance, too. It speaks awfully well for you. And so a great majority of the class was there. We spent the whole night on Balaam. Good guy or bad guy? Bad guy. What was he interested in? Money. Whoever will pay him, you know, that's fine with him. And so Balak comes to him. God keeps telling Balaam what? Well, in two letters you could say no. But the first time he said no, Balaam sent more emissary. Balaam got, you know, dollar signs in his eyes, apparently. So what did he do? He didn't take no for an answer from God, did he? No, he went back again to talk to God. This time God said go. And it drives us kind of crazy, because ever after that, God is criticizing the guy for doing something that God told him to do. Okay? But God only told him to do that as a means of accomplishing God's own ends, but also as a, not facetious is the word I want, I guess, but, you know, he was allowing him to do a thing that he ought not to have done, but God permits this guy to have his way. He'll pay for it later. This does not make him a good guy, and it doesn't make God crazy. God did not, was not pleased with his going, but he did permit it. And how many times you've done that with your teenagers, how many times you do it, you know, with your kids, there are times we allow them to learn the lesson how. The hard way. That doesn't mean we're pleased with them, doesn't mean we're giving them permission to do that, we're not encouraging that thing. Sometimes you have to learn the hard way. So, Balaam makes some four prophecies, and I love the way the chronological Bible did it. On page 175, it gives you a title for each one. Chapter 23, first prophecy, starting there at verses 1 and following. Second prophecy is on the right-hand side of the page, 175, at verse 13. When you turn the page and come into chapter 24, you'll see the third prophecy takes place and the fourth. So verses 3 through 9 are prophecy, and then verses 15 down through 24. As I mentioned Sunday night, each of these prophecies is more extensive or powerful or revealing or informative. Each one seems to give us, you know, additional information until finally, when you get into the fourth prophecy, look at verse 17 in chapter 24. 24:17. I see him. What did they do with the word him? Capitalize the first letter. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not what? Not near. So this prophecy is what? This one's in the distant future. Not near like some of these others. This is out a ways. A star shall come from Jacob. A scepter. What is a scepter? A symbol of? King holds that rod, and that says, I'm the king. Yeah, authority. Okay, will rise out of Israel and batter the brow of Moab and destroy all the sons of tumult. And Edom shall be a possession. Seir also, and it continues on. In verse 19, out of Jacob, one shall have dominion and destroy the remains of the city. And the one is capitalized. Somebody asked me this week, and I couldn't find it. This went on top of my head. Jerry will probably know, some of the elders, somebody else. But where do we have Jesus described as ruling with a rod of iron? Now, it's in Revelation, I think, but isn't it also in the Old Testament?
my answer was, I think it comes up quite a few times in several different passages, both Old Testament and New. What is the whole point about Jesus ruling with a rod of iron? Can he ever be defeated? Physically or spiritually? Well, and in Daniel's prophecy, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's dream, what will happen to all four of the composite parts of the vision, the man that Nebuchadnezzar saw? They will all be pulverized and crumbled. Jesus did that. And will they ever rise again? Blow it away. Jerry?
The Old Testament passage that you wanted in Psalm 2, verse 9.
Psalm 2 is where the Old Testament rod of iron is, okay? And then again comes up in the New Testament as well. So it's a common theme that this one who has this scepter is going to be ruling. Now, is he going to only rule for a brief period of time? No. And is he only going to rule spiritually? No, he also rules physically. He rules all the nations. So their rise and fall throughout time, brethren, since the coming of the Messiah, is directly attributable to the reign of Jesus the Christ. What will happen to the United States of America when the Lord's done with us? Same thing has happened to everybody else. Will there be anything you can do about it? When the time comes, then what? It's over. And this is going to hinge on us electing the right president, is it? It's going to matter who we elect. Jesus is ruling when we have served his purposes as a nation, as has been the case with every other nation, and apparently, if Genesis 15 is any rule, when our iniquity is full, like that of the Amorite was in Genesis 15, then what's going to happen? We are toast. Okay, that's right. And so, what is our responsibility as Christians, brethren, in any nation who are being ruled by the one who holds the scepter and who rules with a rod of iron? What is our responsibility? Serve God. What was the Jews' responsibility way back then when they were still under the old law? Same thing. Play your role. Be a light to the world. Show the world what the truth is. Is Balaam accomplishing this? No. He's an utter failure and becomes a synonym for failure. He becomes the Judas. He becomes the Benedict Arnold. He becomes the Adolf Hitler. He becomes the Pharaoh of his time. He's the guy that is synonymous with greed and with fighting God to try to get his own way. And yet, his prophecies are some of the greatest there are. And at the end of that fourth prophecy, you can see then after the mention of the Messiah, in verse 20, he deals with Amalek. In 21, he deals with the Kenites. In 22, he deals with Asher, which is the Assyrians. They're way on the distant horizon, time-wise. In 24, you've got Cyprus. And so you've got all these different nations. These prophecies culminate in whom? The Christ. And the rule of nations for all time to come. Now, that will bring us, and I moved that too fast, so let me back up here, to chapter 25. And in chapter 25, in the early going, verse 1, Israel remained in Acacia Grove. The people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. The people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and that, again, is the proper way to pronounce it. I had a Hebrew-speaking tour guide in Israel who explained that to me. It's not Baal, it's Baal of Peor. And the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. The Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, every one of you kill his men who were joined to Baal of Peor. Now skip down to verse 9, right-hand column. Those who died in the plague were how many? 24,000. There was the sword and the plague, and when we're done, because of Baal, the idol, in Peor, Then, how many are dead?
24,000 people. It was bad. Now, do the reading. Hope. No. Who's at the root, at the heart of all this problem at Peor? Who is it? It's Balaam. We don't find out till later, but in the reading, chapter 31, you discover that it's Balaam that's behind this. You also find out about it in the New Testament in the passages that we studied last Sunday night. So Old Testament or New, Balaam becomes a pivotal player. And it wasn't just his greed. It was also named two more sins. They're closely related. They're dependent upon each other. But what are these other two sins that he's responsible for here? Idolatry and what usually attends idolatry, fornication of various kinds. So, they had sexual sin used as a form of worship to an idol in Peor. And the guy encouraged it? Balaam. What's he probably looking for? Money. Okay. No, last part name. Go ahead.
Balaam, inspired by God, could not curse Israel. But through the idolatry of the Moabites, he caused the people that is Israel to curse themselves.
Isn't that a great point? And I hadn't even thought about you know, that way, but that Balaam, you know, would have taken the money, and if he could have, he would have cursed Israel. God controlled his mouth and through him an evil man spoke the truth for centuries to come, he foretold the future. But ultimately, where Balaam himself, as Jerry just pointed out, could not actually curse Israel, what did Israel do as a result of his later teaching? As Jerry put it, they cursed themselves, they had 24,000 died.
Now, I thought I saw another hand. Anybody? Okay, so we spent so much time on Balaam and of course, Balak as well that we're just going to pass on that quite a few chapters, but we'll leave that behind now. In chapter 26, what's the title say in the very top of page 178? See, we get another census. So the book is named Numbers because we have all this numbering going on. If you read in chapter 26, verse 1, top of page 178, came to pass after the plague, the Lord spoke to Moses and Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saying, Eleazar's, you know, new high priest. What happened to Aaron in chapter 20? He died. He's buried there on Mount Hor. So he says, verse 2, take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and above by their father's houses, all who were able to go to war in Israel. Does that sound familiar? The exact same phrasing for the first census. How many men of war, 20 years old and above, did they have when they set out into the wilderness? You remember? Oh, you guys are good. Okay. With 603,550. Skip down now to page 179, lower part of the left-hand column. This is still Numbers 26. We're going to start reading at verse 51. These are those who were numbered of the children of Israel. 601,730. So, say for about 25, roughly, how many fewer are they 40 years later? Only 2,000 less. Out of 600,000 plus, they've regenerated an entire what? An entire generation, an entire nation. They have grown to right at the same numbers they had when they left to begin with 40 years ago, which, of course, is marvelous. And God's restoring them now as he is about finally to fulfill his promise despite their unfaithfulness. Now then, in verses 52 and following there, immediately after what we just read, you have these inheritances now, and so we're going to get a great deal of information in this book, not just here, but elsewhere about both numberings and then some locations for where the 12 tribes are going to settle, the kinds of cities they're going to build, you know, various information, including in chapter 27, what's the title there in the bottom right of page 179? These inheritance laws. Whoever these daughters of Zelophehad were, they were sure pretty influential, weren't they? The daughters of Zelophehad pop up twice. And both times, they make a legal plea for land as women who do not have what? Husbands. And in both cases, do they win or lose? They win. God being very fair to them, it's unusual and too bad that you're not married, and yet we don't want the family name to lose its inheritance to Israel that you're about to receive, nor its inheritance down to the ages after this. So both times God rules in their favor. They will become landowners in the families of Manasseh from the two sons of Joseph. So what's sometimes referred to as the half-tribe, because Joseph's two sons both received inheritances as tribes. Jimmy, you have a question? I'm sorry, Jimmy, I can't hear you.
I may have a funny question, but it says not a man was left. It doesn't say anything about the women several times, so is that a generic term? Nobody left with not children, but...
No, I'm not sure that I can answer the question, Jimmy. I just don't know. I always understood it. And commentators seem to understand it. You know, it's just that they themselves were not married, but to the extent of beyond that, I'm not sure I know.
When you and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, I don't remember where you said the scripture was, but everyone who grumbled died before the inheritance. Now that certainly wasn't only the man.
Oh, was I missing Jimmy's question maybe, but I wasn't missing your question. Okay. If it goes back to what Bill and I were talking about, it is not just the men who were 20 years old and more that voted for the 10 faithless spies that died. Now, this is a compound sentence for you. I remember when I was a kid, one of my teachers said as an assignment, we had to write a single sentence that had 50 words in it. I was delighted. And I couldn't break the habit ever since, so sorry about that. Okay. What I'm trying to say is, we need to look it up, Bill and I, and we found several different ways that it says that all the congregation died. All the children of Israel died. And very clearly it was also including the women. And so it was not just the men who refused, you know, to go to the battle, but also their wives and you know, the women folk as well. So in addition to 603,548 men, who were the two that didn't die, Joshua and Caleb. Now, the 603,548, you know, who did die, they're numbered as men. But apparently all their wives, many of the women in the congregation, you know, had sided with them and also, you know, perished in that. So it was huge. Okay, so now in chapter 27, if you'll turn the page and come on over to page 180, in 180, which is chapter 27, at verse 12. Now the Lord said to Moses, go up into this Mount Abiram and see the land which I've given to the children of Israel. When you've seen it, you also shall be gathered to your people as Aaron your brother was gathered. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to hallow me at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah at Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. So, Moses is warned. He is told, your time has come. And so, I'm giving you your last command. I want you to make this march, and when that's over, then it'll be over. You will be gathered to your people. So, Moses, from this point on, he's already been told, of course, but Moses, you know, right now is a few months away from his death. Can you imagine how he must have felt? How old is he?
20, okay? And now he's being specifically told, you got one last mission, okay? How would you feel? I think it would be, I was going to say, it's the very epitome of mixed emotions. There will be for him some relief.
But how about disappointment? You know, there's that too. He's not going into that promised land. So now, and skip over 15, 16, 17, go to the very top of the right-hand column at verse 18. Lord said to Moses, take Joshua the son of Nun with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. See, laying on of hands is not just a New Testament practice. Set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and inaugurate him in their sight. You shall give your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At this word they shall go out, at his word they shall go out, at his word they shall come in, he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation. So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. Now it'll be later, we were being told in advance, but he went off to do it. So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua, set him before Eleazar the priest, before all the congregation, laid his hands on him, inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded, by the hand of Moses. So, with a laying on of hands ceremony, which Old Testament or New is simply a way for any given group of people to inaugurate, to set in place, to give a man authority for whatever mission, purpose, office that he is to fulfill, laying hands on him was a means, a ceremony, by which he was, you know, set in place. By the way, we have the laying on of hands before, only not with people. What else have we been laying hands on?
Laying on of hands
and sin on the goat. That's right. We have the laying on of hands, various animals and sacrifice as well. In each case, in both cases, brethren, what happens when you physically go over and you lay hands on somebody, I'm surprised you're not going here. But when you lay hands on somebody, what are you doing? When you shake hands, what are you doing? You are intimately associating yourself with this individual. You are showing a bond. You want physically for everybody to see how close you are to this individual. And the sins, of course, are being then associated with your sins are associated now with the animal and its sacrifice or the scapegoat leaving for the wilderness.
Do you know why they would have said back up in verse 19 that you shall give some of your authority? To why would they have said that?
You got that I skipped over that. Well, I tell you, these people just watch me like a hawk. Okay, so look at verse 20. The word some is in italics, which indicates it wasn't in the original text. And you shall give of your authority to him. Now, it's likely that it did intend not to say all of your authority. You are to give of your authority. And in the expression of it, you could also translate from it. What would be the idea? That it wasn't all of it. You gave something of it, you know, from it. So, you know, I didn't read it just because it's an italicized word, but did Joshua enjoy the same relationship with God that Moses did?
No,
he really did not. And so, you know, I think it's probably correct to say that he really did not quite have the same authority that Moses did. And at least this we can certainly say, was Moses a prophet? Yes. Was Moses a leader? Yes. Was Moses chosen by God? Yes. Are all those things true of Joshua as well? Yeah, they are. Was Moses a lawgiver? Was Joshua? No. What Joshua got was responsibility with regard to the law. But when God was done with Moses, how much of the law did the Jews have? They had it all. They had the whole system. And they'd been practicing it in the wilderness. They would now carry this fully formed and new religion with them into Israel, where it would be practiced down until the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD.
that turned over to God.
That's correct, and that's important. You will often see this, that a mentor will work with a protege until, you know, the transition actually takes place. And we have great difficulty with timelines and establishing years for kings and whatnot in Scripture. Just a terrible time with it, because this is frequently the case in a dynasty where fathers and sons, you know, are handing down authority one generation after the other. And the term that is used for the overlap is called a co-regency. A co-regency. And it just drives chronologists crazy, because it'll mention the first year of the son, you know, so-and-so, and their first year became king. But he might be that king from that year for the next 4 years, and his daddy is still king living too. So you get this overlap. It's not like, you know, how much overlap do we get with presidents? January 20th or 21st, whatever it is, one ends and the other begins, and is there even a moment of overlap? No! We're booting out in the helicopter and waving goodbye. Done. So, good luck. You know, we don't see you anymore.
And that was just wasn't the case, you know, in a kingdom system like this. Okay, now, I'm going to skip over several chapters again. Chapter 28, what do you see as you scan the titles in the chronological Bible? Daily offering, Sabbath offering. They've got a whole chart at the top of 181. It's a great chart at the top of 181. Nice little condensed, you know, graph to show you these various festivals, sacred times they're calling them, that they were practicing. But as you turn the page into chapter 29, you'll see the same thing continues. Now we've got Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles. We talked about these extensively when we're in Leviticus. We've talked about them already here, you know, in Numbers as well. So we're just gonna pass over that. Now, effectively, I'm just going to pass over chapter 30 as well. This we've already had a question about in another class. It is a curiosity to us in our culture that in their time and place and law, could a woman make a vow just like a man? Yes and no. She's sure she could make it. Then, after a woman makes a vow, what will have to happen before that vow is going to be inaugurated? She's living at home, then daddy's going to have to sign off on it. If she's married, then her husband's going to have to sign off on it. And if they nix it, then what? We use the word hit. She should be relieved. Many times, making a vow is a foolish thing. Not always. I'm not saying, you know, always, but the Lord gave us some counsel about that too later, and so it's a dangerous thing at least. So maybe some relief as well. Hand, Bill.
When a woman makes the vow, if the male person that's in authority, if he just remains silent, he doesn't actually have to sign off, but if he doesn't mention it, then it's okay.
That's correct. If he just remains silent, then the vow stands. Okay? Saber?
This is often, you know, a struggle for us in that teaching of Jesus. Is it a sin to make a vow despite what Jesus said tonight? It's not a sin. Clearly, Paul demonstrates that. The advice and the counsel that Jesus was giving there was just that. Let your yes be yes, and your no be no, and don't be raising your right hand and go square, you know, all that, because you ought to be living your life in such a manner that this business is what? Totally unnecessary. Nobody should be ever looking at you and saying, well, that's what you say, but I can't trust you. So now, I'm going to need for you to invoke some higher authority and stipulate a penalty or something if you break it, because I just can't trust you anymore. Have you ever trusted in somebody and they failed you? Sure. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. They lose that trust.
So don't ever lose it. Your name is vastly important to you, you know, and so let your yes be yes, your no be no, and if it always is and everybody knows it, then, you know, let the vows go. Okay, now, in chapter 31, we have the Midianites being defeated there, but we've already touched on the successes of Israel militarily as they're moving up the eastern side of the Promised Land, and so we're going to touch on that. But somebody asked a moment ago, maybe it was Carol, the passage you were looking for, I think, is in verse 15 of chapter 31. It's on the middle of page 184 on the left-hand column, 31:15. Moses said to them, "Have you kept all the women alive? Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam, now we learn, to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor. There was a plague among the congregation of the Lord." How many died? 24,000. All right. "Now therefore, kill every male among the little ones. Kill every woman who's known a man intimately. Keep alive for yourselves all the young girls who have not known a man intimately. As for you, remain outside the camp 7 days, whoever's killed any person and whoever's touched any slain. Purify yourselves and your captives on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. Now, I know my time's escaping, but I just want to say, brethren, this just boggles our minds, you know, just crosses our eyeballs when we see this. And it's often used against us because we look out at Saddam Hussein and a host of others, you know, we see them doing similar things like this, and we roundly condemn that. And then, you know, the irreligious world accuses us of hypocrisy, because here we are on our high and mighty, you know, saying that that's a bad thing when God did it in the Old Testament, so you guys don't really believe the Bible, you know, and all the rest of that. Look, when God rules on a given circumstance, then what? That's the way it's going to be. Does he know more than you do? Yes, he does. And does he have to explain to you his every reason? No, he does not. And today, when we see atrocities, you know, taking place and all the rest of that, God is no longer working with those people or with Christians the way he did with the Jews while they were under the old law. What I suspect, brethren, is this. God knows when a nation is so corrupt that even its youngest have already seen and witnessed too much. How many of you have ever read an article that says by the time a child is 3, their character is fully formed and there's little more you're going to do about it? I've read lots of that stuff. You know, psychologists bandy, you know, about all this stuff. You know, I'm not claiming any of that's been proven, but, you know, you will find that at a very young age, children take a set, is what I call it. And if mom and dad really does the best job they can, you know, up to that point, then good. They've had a profoundly good influence. But if you're living in a nation that is just wholesale given over to sin, you know, then by the time they're 3 or 4 years old, what have their ears and eyes been filled with every day they were consciously awake? You know, it's evil. And it's already buried deeply enough. I think God knows when there's just no redeeming them. And then the differences between men and women and all of that, again, God's decisions. I can't say that I, you know, would give the same direction today if somebody made me president, you know, by any means. But what was true then was right then, and no reflection on how we might view a similar incident here today. Now, that's what brings us to chapter 32, and the reason why I had these maps I got up erroneously before. We have much more to say with this, but as you know, there are 12 tribes, they're each going to be a portion of their land in very specific detail, even to get the geographical boundaries. Manasseh, one of the two sons of Joseph, Gad, and Reuben, we will learn in this chapter, as they were marching along up the King's Highway and beating Sihon and Og, you know, and seeing what it was like to be in Moab and, you know, the invasion, you know, and they get up into this land, and what do they realize? For sheep's sake. Great grazing land. So, what did they want in chapter 32? They said, well, hey, we think that we would like to have our inheritance over here on the east side of the Jordan River. They took it to God, which is exactly what they're supposed to do. God made a ruling. What did God say? He said, okay, what was the one provision? You guys get, you know, to have your land over here,
and you had all the children of Israel fighting for you when we were beating these guys. Now, the rest of Israel has to cross the Jordan. What's facing them? All kinds of battle and conflict. You don't get to stay home and wish them well. What are you going to do? You'll fight with them. If you do that, and I'll let you go. Now then, you'll see in 33, we started the class with that. 41, encampments. And as you turn to just the last couple of chapters, 34, 35, and 36, we have this division of the land. We have the Levites being told how they will be supported. We are told about the cities of refuge. And all of that material we're going to be dealing with in great detail later. So, within 60 seconds of the bell ringing, I got everything done. Maybe last time. I want it in the record. Anybody have a comment or question?